On this month's Bandscan, some Midsummer Madness. This is Mark Dernberger. DX Audio Service listeners know that we like to take our receivers everywhere we can across this great land of ours. Next month, we report from the Ludington Ferry on Lake Michigan. But this month's column is set aside for a few fun features of interest to listeners of all ages. Ask a DXer how he or she got started listening to radio, and you'll discover most of us had something in common. We started as kids, and we quickly learned that the best AM radio listening was after dark, usually late at night. For most kids, that meant after bedtime. And since necessity is the mother of invention, that meant we had to design our own parent-proof listening post. For those of us who have been there, we dedicate this mini-production called Under the Covers.
I got into nighttime reception, of course, when I was a kid, with the radio under the covers.
I'm listening to it late in the night.
Remember that you can take your radio entertainment with you wherever you go.
I remember taking my favorite radio to bed with me every night.
And one of the exciting things was saying goodnight to your parents and going upstairs and having your radio.
When my mother would make me go to bed, they'd tuck me in and I'd reach over on the floor, lift up the little transistor radio, put it under the pillow.
Putting it under your pillow and turning it on.
And I used to put it under my pillow.
But I had my little transistor radio.
My first real radio was a Zenith tabletop, which I then took to bed and dragged under the covers.
And since there were no earplugs or anything, I would sort of bury it in the pillow. My ear right on the speaker.
I remember very, very late at night putting the blankets over me and the pillow so that nobody would hear it and listening to the radio.
If anybody opened the door to check on me, they couldn't tell that there was a radio going.
I turned it on so no one would see a light.
I got my radio on. You gotta wait maybe 8 days. Heat up,
I would be trying to sing along, and then once in a while the radio would go out of, like, the airwaves would go away, and you'd go, and then you'd hear, wing away, a wing away, a wing away, and you'd go,
spring together. And then I'd, there's good news, leave me.
Like really difficult to listen to, but I never got caught listening to the radio at night.
Of course, my parents didn't know that.
No one else was there. No one else heard it but you.
Radio Luxembourg would come on with its top 20 Sunday nights.
The big events of the night was always the top three.
And this was like the Bible. This replaced church. If you didn't listen, you were not cool. You were not in. You couldn't go to school.
I think that came on usually around 11 or 12, and that's when reception was at its best in those days.
It was neat to lay there in bed and hear those stations from so far coming through the cold winter night.
What a thrill it was to get distance.
And I was checking out WBZ and KDKA.
I sat in Chicago and got Jada from KDKA.
How about the time you got fired from WGN?
I'm having a good time and I fell asleep with the radio on.
Of course, that usually happened to me. I'd fall asleep with the radio on. And usually when I woke up, the radio would have been mysteriously turned off. I'd like to think that I turned it off myself, but I have a hunch it was my mom, though she never said a word about it. I also know that sometimes when I fell asleep, I missed some momentous events.
I must have fallen asleep and then wakened because the music stopped and there was some kind of urgent voice coming on.
And radio offers the finest and up-to-the-minute news.
That there'd been a terrible plane accident. And Buddy Holly and Richie Valens and the Big Bopper were dead. And it was like devastating. There I was, 10 or 11 years old, in the middle of the night, all by myself. I couldn't share it with anybody because then I'd be in trouble for listening to the radio.
And you fall asleep and you wake up and hear the static in the morning and know you were still friends.
Boy, does that bring back memories for most of us, I betcha. And yes, that was the familiar voice of our friend and longtime Bandscan editor Jim Snowbarger. The sound out of those old tube radios was semi-awesome.
I remember the first time I found that some AM stations sounded much clearer when I tuned slightly off the center, and then found that the sound of the station would vary as the tubes warmed up and the radio tuning drifted around. It was wizardry.
Just magic. Wow.
Well, one day I did come to figure out what was going on with the tuning and the tubes warming up, and why I could make a station sound so much brighter. And I know you'll understand when I tell you that once I got the technical explanation, some of the magic went out of the experience. And nowadays, when I try listening under the pillows with my Sony digitally synthesized radio, it just isn't as much fun. But nighttime radio under the covers as a kid was something I'll always remember.
I hate to say it, but it changed my life.
Next, some pirate radio of a sort. A couple of dozen years ago, the FCC was trying to reinvigorate an ailing emergency alerting system called EBS. This was happening about the same time FM was beginning to emerge as a new, powerful, yet still uncontrolled medium. And many of the guys who developed FM started in freeform or underground radio operations. And for them, discipline was not a part of their vocabulary. Yet there was an innocence of sorts, since this was long before the shock jock era, when so many immature idiots think they have to be obscene to be acceptable. Back then, a major challenge to authority was making fun of the FCC's efforts to promote the EBS test. To understand what follows, you have to remember that the old emergency broadcast system consisted of a 22-second tone followed by an alerting announcement. The very formality of the procedure invited mockery. This is what some Southern California radio guys did to the EBS test.
All right, men, it's time for the big test. Let's hope it works.
This is a test. For the next 60 seconds, this station will conduct a test of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test. Yeah! Test of the emergency broadcast system.
Boy, don't even have the broadcasters of this area, in voluntary cooperation with the FCC and other authorities, have developed this little system to keep you informed in the event of an emergency. If this had been an actual emergency, you would have been instructed where to tune in your area for news and official information.
This concludes this test of the emergency broadcast system.
Remember, this was only a test.
So there you have it, the Radio Renegades version of the EBS test. My recollection is a bit unclear, but I believe several broadcasters ran this and consequently had their fingers slapped. Finally, on our August Midsummer Madness, some super long-distance DXing. A Mars bounce in 1939. 60 years ago this summer. Ever since the H.G. Wells novels and Sir Percival Lowell's announcement that a series of lines he observed crisscrossing the planet were really canals, people on Earth had been given to wonder if there really might be intelligent life on Mars, and more importantly, whether we could ever communicate with Mars. In 1924, as Mars and the Earth came closer together than they had been since 1804, there was renewed interest in listening for radio signals from the sister planet. Quoting now from Thomas White's work, Extraterrestrial DX, circa 1924. Thanks to the march of science, Earth now had a powerful new communications tool, radio. Millions had witnessed the miracle of capturing signals from half a continent away. Transatlantic signals were being received with regularity. Would not a Martian civilization, builders of a canal system far beyond the capabilities of humans, be thoroughly versed in the advanced use of radio? On earlier passes close to Earth, Marsmen may have attempted to communicate, but we weren't listening. Now, today, in August 1924, Earth and Mars would come to within 35 million miles of each other, and perhaps for the first time, the Martians would find us listening. End quote. The publicity surrounding the alignment of the planets led to a series of listening tests, as people across the country vied to be the first to hear some super long-distance DX.
Broadcasting and wireless stations were urged to shut down and go on listening watch at regular periods. Few complied. Reception was all they could try at that time. Transmission toward Mars in 1924 was considered an impossibility. No one believed a big enough transmitter could be built to actually send a signal toward Mars. But by 1939, the march of technology had led some folks to believe it was worth a try.
The planet Mars, ironically enough, made one of its periodic approaches to the Earth, coming as near our planet as it ever does. Millions saw the pink star hanging low in the east, and WOR Special Features Division tried a unique experiment. No one knows whether it is possible to send a radio signal through the dense atmospheric layers surrounding the Earth.
In 1924, RCA engineers had calculated that it would take a 1 million megawatt transmitter to pass signals between the planets, and that in any case, the ionosphere surrounding the Earth would stop the signals. In the 15 years between 1924 and 1939, radio propagation came to be better understood, and there were some engineers who now felt it was worth trying.
WOR engineers tried to do it, and ambitiously set about preparing an attempt to transmit those signals directly to Mars, hoping they would strike that planet and, bouncing off, return again to Earth. The attempt was broadcast to listeners throughout the country, and many of them will remember the tense scene at the transmitter when the WOR announcer told them all was ready.
Now, engineer Charles Singer will press a key, and the dots and dashes that you will hear will be picked up as they are transmitted from a special antenna beamed at Mars. All right, here we go. Signals are on their way, and if they have penetrated through the Kennelly-Heaviside layer, a magnetic layer some 50 miles to 100 miles above the Earth, it is reasonable to believe that they will continue on through space and strike Mars.
Well, the 1939 Mars bounce signals were on their way, and now came the wait for the return bounce.
Across the country, people listened, and then the minutes ticked off.
While we're waiting for the return signal from Mars, it's interesting to note that this same WOR had established a Sirius listening post during the 1924 alignment and had reported hearing a series of Morse code-like dashes which were never explained. But let's get back to our 1939 listening watch.
All right, I'm going to take a look at the clock now and see how much more time we must wait before our 6 minutes and 28 seconds are consumed, and we may expect to hear the signal flash back to Earth if we're lucky. How much more time? Let's see. 45 seconds to go before we should hear the start of the signal as it was sent out from here just a few minutes ago.
Still waiting. Remember, this Mars bounce was tried just a few months after the famous Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast, and a lot of folks would not have been surprised had they heard signals returning from Mars.
So let's pause now and wait, if you'll be patient, and see if we hear the signal return. Of our experiment, the signal failed to return, and so we're going to conclude this broadcast in which we have attempted to send the signal to Mars and back to Earth.
Boy, he dumped out of that in a hurry, didn't he?
This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
WOR, Newark.
And there you have it, a bit of fun radio stuff.